This is Maria Vasquez Boyd, and you are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Turkey Day. Thanks for tuning in to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is Maria Vasquez Boyd, and you're listening to ArtSpeak Radio here from the little old radio station at 39th and Main. You know, we've got some terrific guests in the house, in the studio today. Renee Cinderhaus, Hector Casanova, Patrick Alexander, Corey Emig, and Melanie Mitchell. We're all here, you know, ready to share some information and some really wonderful conversation with you about the arts, past and present. So, you know, we're going to start off today with our friends Renee Cinderhaus, Hector Casanova, and Pat Alexander. We're going to talk about some of the gallery spaces from past that they created and operated and really nurtured other artists, local artists here in Kansas City. And we're going to talk about their experiences here, and so we're going to share with you right now. So welcome, Renee and Hector and Pat.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Maria.
Hello,
thanks.
Friends. Great. You know, I know that we had a conversation about this at the Kansas City Artists Coalition back in the spring, summer, and that sort of thing, and it was really wonderful to hear about these spaces that each of you created just because you wanted this gallery experience, not only for yourselves. You're very generous in inviting other artists to show their work and really sort of nurture their careers. So let's begin talking about the Green Door Gallery, because, you know, you're right here next to me. So let's get started about talking about that. Would you, Renee? And
absolutely, Hector? Yes, and thanks for having me today.
Absolutely.
So the Green Door Gallery started in 2000, and we ran for about 8 years. We closed in 2008. And during that time, we had a regular exhibition program. We initiated as an artist collective with a small group of us for the first show. But then shortly after that, the gallery became co-curated and co-directed by myself and Hector Casanova. And we curated an artist-run space to showcase local and national emerging artists, sort of at the teetering point of a transition in their careers between having established an artistic voice, having a drive and a unique signature style or a vision, and yet hadn't quite professionally graduated to being able to get large solo national shows or, you know, one and two person shows. And we were also emerging artists ourselves at the time, and again struggling on that teetering point. And so it was a difficult time. You know, the country was, when we started, it was right around 9/11 in 2001, and so things were shifting dramatically, politically, artistically in the country at that point. And so we were struggling to make enough money and sustain our art practice, still be able to provide sometimes very high gallery application fees. And then typically, if you were accepted into a lot of these shows, the galleries would take a 50% cut of your work.
Mm-hmm.
We found that there was a huge gap, not only locally, but nationally, to provide shows that were accessible to artists, to give them visibility, and yet, not financially make it difficult at the same time. So we worked on creating a different structure for our gallery.
You know, and I want to mention that also, the Green Door Gallery, you didn't see the other galleries in the West Bottoms, because that's where you were located, as competitors, but really more as family, right? Because at that time there was, the Dirt, the Fahrenheit?
Absolutely. Far as the West Bottoms was concerned, yeah. At that time, the Dirt and the Fahrenheit kind of were land standers down there, and we kind of joined the ranks. And through the years that we were open and overlapped in our gallery openings, we would unify to have communal events, street parties, basically just unite to make a counterculture art destination out of the West Bottoms at that time.
Right. Also, I think maybe Random Ranch was gone by then. I'm not sure. But I think Eric
Swansu
mm-hmm. took it over, and I don't remember what the name of that was, but that was a thriving studio nearby, right?
Yes, Random Ranch was one of the first galleries there in the West Bottoms. And, Renee mentioned that this was a time when a lot of us, artists that were starting out, usually starting your career is a time of struggle.
Yeah.
But at the same time, both Renee and I came into Kansas City from outside. I grew up in Mexico City. And I lived in a lot of different cities before I settled in Kansas City. And one of the things that really struck me about the city is that the cost of living was really low to begin with, which was great. There was a lot of space that was available for artists, a lot of raw industrial spaces.
Very raw, yeah.
So at that point, the West Bottoms was basically deserted. It really was not being utilized for commerce or really hardly anything. There are some warehouses and trucking businesses, but for the most part, it seemed like the city was kind of ignoring that whole part of town. So the rent was ridiculously cheap, and a lot of artists moved in and were running studio spaces or living there, and we were fortunate enough to be able to get a big warehouse space there. So we have the space.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have to pay a lot in rent. And we kind of created this community where all of our neighbors, the few neighbors that we had, were all other artists or musicians mm-hmm. who also had gallery spaces. So we would kind of create a very supportive community. And because the cost of living was so low, we were able to operate these large gallery spaces and have these kind of events where we could give access to artists that were starting out. So that they could have large shows and get more momentum in their careers going. So it was both a time of difficulty, but it was also a very fertile time. And there was mm-hmm. Just this immense pool of talent in Kansas City that we felt could use more visibility, so we were able to provide that.
And it was a great time for experimentation and trying things on and, just really having that freedom, that, moment to just try something out and really give that artist an experience that they wouldn't normally have, right?
Well, and it was also kind of, it's shocking in retrospect. I mean, just our gallery alone, we had 2,000 square feet of gallery space with 10-foot ceilings that we could dedicate at times to a one- or two-person show or one on occasion a solo show for an emerging artist. And because we were not taking a gallery percentage, we mm-hmm. made that decision early to give 100% of any art sales directly to the artist, since we were not running this as a business. And even early on when we had considered taking a percentage, it was only 30%. And again, we realized early on that our books were never going to balance for an exhibition, so why not, again, just find a means to directly support these artists, not just with, their resume and portfolio that would come out of a show like this, but also with anything monetary. And that then allowed us to leap into much more experimental shows, much more grand installation-based art, things that were not collectible or archival, things that were not necessarily going to sell, but were very important, to experience artistically and to be able to transform a space on that scale is a rare opportunity, really. So
it really is. And another thing that I find very rare was that everything that you did for this gallery, and it was a living space later on, everything was really out of pocket. And based on your dedication and your passion to fill this void in the art gallery, art world here in Kansas City.
It definitely supported us in other ways. I mean, it allowed us to both have both a collective curatorial voice and an independent curatorial voice. We were both art history majors as well as art major histories. I was sculpture, and actor, you were
illustration.
Yeah. And so clearly we had different ideologies approaching curation, and a lot of times when we would travel to museums and other large known upper-level fine art galleries in other large cities, there was only sort of one zeitgeist that was being shown, and there's a whole lot of other voices out there that were equally strong that were not getting the visibility, and this allowed us a means to have a voice in that conversation.
So at that time at the Green Door Gallery, you were selecting artists based on their work and maybe something that they offered that you wouldn't traditionally see in an art gallery, right?
Right. So I think our main curatorial strategy was basically that since we didn't have to worry about art sales, we didn't really even care if the work would be for sale. We would just leave that decision up to the artists. Mm-hmm. So we were seeking out artists who we found were making interesting work, and we would let them basically we just give them the opportunity to and I would often approach an artist and say, if you had 2,000 square feet and a month mm-hmm. to show whatever work you wanted to make, what would you do? And if they seemed to get excited and they would give me an exciting answer, then I would say, well, let's do it. Let's have a show. So we were just seeking out artists whose work was really compelling and who were not getting enough visibility. So we were always kind of like scouting out artists, and we would receive a lot of submissions over the mail as well. But yes, the general strategy was basically to just show the most interesting work that we could find, and since we had to pay for the rent for the space anyway, we were able to not worry about it being for sale or selling.
Sure.
Well.
Can you give us some examples of some memorable work that went through the galleries that kind of sticks in your mind to this day?
Sure. From my perspective, because we both had our own curatorial perspective, a lot of the artists that I sought out or worked with directly were more mixed media sculpture-based installation artists. Mm-hmm. So we had a couple, Divine and Winnin, come in and do a show called Cohabitation, which it was an artist couple who created large sculptural collaborative works and then created a full installation in our gallery that was over the ceiling and transformed the space entirely. And then Hector kind of spearheaded other more sort of lowbrow media at the time and more of the bringing in musicians. And do you want to speak about maybe step into the arena a little?
Since I studied illustration, I was coming at it from an angle that was questioning that division between fine art and commercial art or applied art and highbrow and lowbrow art. So I often found that some of the work that was dismissed by the highbrow or fine art establishment was very compelling. Mm-hmm. And I used the gallery to kind of blur the line between those two kind of types of art making and would create shows that would bring artists and artwork that would normally not be seen in galleries or museums, bring them into a gallery context. So we organized a multi-gallery event called Sequence, where we had comic book artists making gallery work. We also had another show where we invited tattoo artists to make work for galleries and then fine artists to make tattoo-themed artwork. Probably my favorite event that we had was called Step Into the Arena. And for that one, it was a live art event where we had two graffiti artists, two comic book artists, and two fine art painters kind of doing a tag team, like, wrestling match of sorts where we all were doing live art on a wall while we had two dueling DJs playing music at the same time. So there was a performative aspect to it. There was live art, and there was, you know, lowbrow and highbrow art all being created simultaneously.
Wow. You know, if you just tuned into ArtSpeak Radio, I'm talking to talking with Renee Sinderhouse and Hector Casanova, and we're talking about the Green Door Gallery, which began in 2000. For some reason, I kept thinking it was a little bit further back, but, you know, it ran through 2008, right?
Mm-hmm. It did indeed, yeah.
And it really afforded artist-run space that gave some wonderful exhibitions of work, and so really that was that you wouldn't find elsewhere in other galleries and that sort of thing. So do you believe that the need for artist-run spaces still exists today? Because obviously it was back then when you created Green Door.
Yeah, I think it's probably even more so now, because to a large extent, the West Bottoms really served as a haven for artists, you know, through the 90s into the, you know, the first decade of the 2000s. So for about 20 years, there was just a succession of artist-run spaces mm-hmm. that were kind of nested in the, or based in the West Bottoms. And then over the last 10 years or so, the West Bottoms really took a sharp turn and have now become commercialized as for antique stores and so on, which I'm sure makes the building owners much happier, because they're able to charge much higher rent than they were doing when it was just artists living there. But now we don't really have that kind of localized space where multiple artist-run galleries can be operating. Mm-hmm. There's some in the East Crossroads, but even those, you know, as the Crossroads has gotten more expensive and more successful, artists keep on dispersing. Some artists have moved to the Northeast. Some have moved to KCK. But we don't have that kind of localized area where you could just wander around and there'd be a half dozen artist-run spaces.
Walk across the train tracks and go to KC site, you know, which is now the I forget what it's called now, at that 1427 East Ninth or West Ninth Street. Full of artists and studios and all that, but thank you. It's just not as affordable as when I was there. So after 7 years of ongoing exhibitions, the Green Door Gallery officially closed in February of 2008, and you went out in style with the final farewell musical Fandango. You want to talk about that?
Yes, we basically... and, you know, we had very, very cool landlords that were... they gave us a heads up, they gave us plenty of notice that we would need to look for a different space to live. So we were able to plan ahead, and we had a big art sale, just a big moving sale, and had a couple of bands playing music for our kind of final event, American Catastrophe and EIO, the Experimental Instrument Orchestra. Mm-hmm. We basically sold everything that we could as we were moving out. But it was a bittersweet time, for sure.
Sure. Does it ever cross your mind that you may want to try this again? And maybe kind of, here's the last, you know, and maybe kind of think about, you know, what work within the pros and cons and all that, but maybe on a smaller scale? Is that a possibility? Come on, Hector.
The thing is that, you know, as Renee mentioned, we started out as an artist collective, and there was five or six of us when we started out. And we never really thought too far ahead when we started. We basically had a big industrial space and a bunch of artists. So the first impulse is, let's have a gallery show. And then after we had a couple of gallery shows, by then we all realized how much work went into keeping a gallery space running and mounting shows, you know, just going through the whole process over and over again.
Sure.
So the other artists that were part of the initial collective, they all kind of dissipated and found other things to do with their time. But Renee and I kept doing it, and it really was a ton of work. I often joke about, again, this was right around the time of, you know, after 9/11 and the war in Iraq. Mm-hmm. I often joke about how we went into the gallery business kind of like the same way that the United States went into the war on terror. We went with, you know, we went basically to shock and awe, and we had no exit strategy. Mm-hmm. So we just kept going, and it was a ton of work.
Especially because we were really attempting to not just do the spontaneous pop-up events. Like, we wanted to transition to running, you know, professional-level gallery for the counterculture and for emerging artists. I mean, that required a lot of lead time. It required a gallery schedule. It required booking exhibitions months in advance to do press release, to get peer review. So After running the gallery, I have continued to curate shows, just not in my own space as a guest curator, and that's something that I am deeply interested in continuing to do. The tipping point comes between also, directing the space and maintaining the overhead. Since I am also a practicing, installation artist, one of the things that was by definition a cost of running a gallery is that it costs me a lot of my own professional pursuits at the same time, because it was just an awful lot to balance.
Well, and I wonder sometimes, of course, the assistance, the funding and all that really wasn't as available then, perhaps, as it is today, and if that would have made a difference, I don't know. I think kind of when you're done, you're done. But fortunately for you, for both of you, your careers flourished and both been very successful in what you do. We're going to take a real quick break. I've got some underwriting to play, and then we're going to be right back, and then we're going to bring that Pat Alexander in. So stay tuned.
Support for KKFI is provided by the Mid-America Regional Council. Do you need health insurance? Are you worried about losing the coverage you already have? Marketplace plans cover pre-existing conditions when other health plans may not. This year, there are new options, and the enrollment period is only 6 weeks, ending December 15th. Most people qualify for financial assistance. Free in-person professional help is available. To connect with trained help near you, you can reach the United Way by dialing 211 or online at coverkc.org.
Do you think the Supreme Court's 2018 anti-worker Janus decision killed public sector unions? Nope. Think again. They've survived, and this week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we give thanks to our unions for fighting back. Also, thanks to the International Labor Communications Association for again awarding us first prize in radio for the show Chris Mann produced in August 2018 called The Attack on Public Employee Unions and How They're Resisting. Eat, drink, and tune in Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
Maria Vasquez-Boyd here with ArtSpeak Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. We're talking to Renee Cinderhaus and Hector Casanova. Hello, friends.
Hi. Hi.
We're talking about the Green Door Gallery and their experience how you go on beyond that. They're both very successful practicing artists. And let's talk about your present positions right now and kind of what you're doing these days.
These days, and for the last 6 years, I have been...
6 years, yeah, great.
I've been teaching at the Kansas City Art Institute in the illustration department, so I am an assistant professor. I shifted from... Before I was working as an illustrator for the Kansas City Star, and then I shifted into teaching, and that has been extremely gratifying. I really love... my students, and I love having this, every year I feel like I get an army of students that I can then deploy into the world.
I like that. Well, and I think, based on your experience as a student, you understand what their needs are and how to really kind of help them and guide them, right?
Yes, and that's, again, I studied illustration, and I went into teaching illustration, I really like the... being able to kind of guide students to understand just the more practical, pragmatic ways of making a living as an artist, which is really what illustration is in the end.
And I want to mention too, because Hector's too humble, he's also received awards from American Illustration, Print and Society of News Designers, and was the recipient of the Pitches Mastermind Award for his artistic contributions to Kansas City. Also, your comic work, it's been very, very successful. So.
I've done a bunch of comics,
graphic novels.
Uh-huh. Kind of looping back to what you were asking earlier about whether I would want to run a gallery again, it really was a juggle, I was always juggling the day job and then my own artistic pursuits, so comics, and then also running the gallery. So thankfully, there's no way we could have done it without each other, Renee and I, because there's times when I just would have to check out because I was just neck deep in a comic book project. So she would take care of all of the gallery related things and vice versa.
Yeah, I was going to say, and with Renee, your sculptures and site specific installations have been shown throughout the U.S. and abroad. There's most notably the Carnegie Museum of Art, Scope Miami, Art LA, the Amarillo Museum of Art and the New Bedford Art Museum. Your immersive works have been staged in wildlife refuges in Costa Rica, Florida, and Wyoming, historic sites and theaters, and several artist residency programs. Because I remember a few years you were in Florida for a residency there?
Actually, the residency I was at was Escape to Create Residency in Seaside, Florida, and that was just for 1 month in February a few years ago. But I have traveled to different artist residencies, and part of the residency programs is to work with found materials and locations and create new narratives also with a lot of my porcelain-based work. So currently, the largest project I'm working on has been in collaboration with the Kansas City Museum as they undergo their massive restoration process. And, of course, that's been going on for a few years now. And so my collaboration with them is sort of a multi-tiered art approach where I have made art time capsules that have been placed on site inside Corinthian Hall. There's going to be one per floor. And so far, three of them have been placed on site during the construction process, so they're now sealed within the walls. And there will be a final stage to the collaboration, which is site-specific installations that I am creating to be interwoven with artifacts from the museum's permanent collection to create a new historically layered narrative. And it's a very exciting body of work.
You know, I can also say that you've done a lot of other collaborations with museum directors outside of Kansas City, Philadelphia, Chicago, and so on, right?
Correct, yes.
And, boy, I tell you, and there's a lot of your work in private collections, both nationally and internationally. So, you know, I understand kind of balancing all this, you know, juggling those, spinning those plates in the air when you had the gallery. It's going to be somewhat of a relief that you now focus, well, for a few years you have focused on your work and really, really gained some recognition for that. So good for you.
Thank you.
Both. Yeah. I mean, it is a relief, and I admit I there's things about running the gallery that I very much miss, just the constant, you know, flow of people and touch with artists and always seeking out other artists. Yeah. But it's really nice also to not have to do it anymore.
I think the most enjoyable aspect for me a lot was sort of after we'd ramp up to a full teardown, reset the gallery, do the whole new hanging and lighting and opening, and then the moment of breath that comes after that, because we also lived there. So we had a 2,000 square foot immersive gallery space that was basically part of my home. So I had this changing exhibition in my house, and it was sometimes just incredible to spend different times with the changing of light and just the changing art. So.
Yeah. You know, and we're looking at Pat Alexander because he's got a similar story, but yet a different experience. You want to join in on the conversation?
Thanks for having us, me and them. I think everyone's had their own experiences in Kansas City of how they've got to where they are. There's no set map, I think, there.
That's true.
Which is one of the reasons it's kept me in Kansas City, I think, for so long, is that freedom to try things, fail, not fail, succeed, you know. And so that's kept me here for quite a while.
It's a good arts town.
It's a great arts town. And it's my hometown, you know. I'm a townie. And that's always, you know, I've been rooting for it for a long time. And, you know, back in the 90s, I briefly went to the Art Institute and left. And then really wanted to focus on more on doing music things at that time and was doing a lot of experimental music and recording. And but there at that time, we really were noticing the landscape. There was not a lot of opportunities for young artists to show in Kansas City at that time. I was also very heavily involved with the kind of music and art stuff in Lawrence at that time, too. So where it seemed like it was kind of thriving a little bit more there. So at a time, we were thinking about a venue that we could showcase all of our friends' stuff, our stuff, but also just meet people. That because we knew there was a lot of creatives, but a big part of it, I think, for us was so many of our friends were moving out of Kansas City at that time. They might have gone to school at the Art Institute or UMKC, And there really just wasn't much there for you to break through. This was, you know, pre-Crossroads. This is pre-downtown, you know.
Yeah.
The Dolphin was probably one of the few places that you could maybe get a show. And even that, as a younger person, there were cool shows, but it almost felt like that was their generation's. And, like, to get in there, it just seemed like I don't even know how you would get into a show at the Dolphin except unless you could hang out there.
Right.
So, my friends Josh Powers and Brian Carter, we searched looking for a venue, and really we were wanting to have performance and visual art together in one space, and we weren't really seeing that in Kansas City. So we started scouting out, looking for venues. We really were going back and forth between Lawrence and Kansas City. Ultimately, we decided Kansas City. We found one space up on Main Street, which I think is like the Silo building or something like that now, which we were going to get the top floor of that, put down a deposit, this guy, cash, and next day or 2 days trying to get a hold of him, could never get a hold of him. So we totally got scammed $500 just at the beginning as we were trying to look for a space, which I think was a blessing because things were moving from out of the Westport Midtown area. I mean, there was a music scene there, but there wasn't much in the visual arts. So we ended up finding a place downtown on 10th and Broadway, which was the old Mr. Guy's shoe warehouse owned by Jerry Berkowitz, which we got really excited about getting the second floor of that, which was 10,000 square feet, and it was a live workspace. And so we got pretty excited about that. It was $1,100 for the rent for three of us to split. You know, it was like we can each have a bedroom, a studio, a recording studio, performance space. I mean, just it kept going and going. And it was a cool, like, New York-style loft. But we had been looking in the West Bottoms for a long time, going to parties. Like, the Dirt had just opened up. And you didn't really know. You had to kind of explore and find it because there was no internet. There was no texting. You know what I mean? You had to, like, go to the record store, like Recycled Sounds or someplace like that. You would find the flyer that was handmade. So talking about all that work that went into the shows, there was also all of the pre-work of those flyers, distributing them. I mean, phone lists were huge to get a phone list because you would call those people and invite them to come to shows. So anyways, yeah, the West Bottoms, the Dirt was cool. We had gone down there, I remember, on New Year's Eve in 97, and they were having a DJ down there, and I mean, literally, I think they still had dirt floors there. That was why they had that name, the Dirt Gallery. And that was down on Union Street. So we went there. Cabs wouldn't even come and get you down in the West Bottoms back then. So I remember we took one down there, but they said we're not coming back. So we were there. It was a decent art show, but it was raw on Union Street, and we just were kind of like, you know, it's right by the train tracks. This is cool. It's a cool nudie set. I don't know if we want to live here. So that's why we got excited about the one downtown in that case.
And that was at 10th and Broadway, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
1000 Broadway. We were on the second floor. It's a historic building now. But at the time, there was not much going on. It was considered Quality Hill. So it was kind of the first neighborhood that when the Irish moved out of the West Bottoms and moved up the hill, that was kind of you made it if you got up to Quality Hill. And so we kind of joked about it that we had made it and we were up on Quality Hill and not down in the bottoms. But it really, the art was probably cooler down there anyways. Anyways, so we just kind of reached out, started reaching out to friends that we had met. But a big part, we weren't from the Art Institute because I dropped out from there. So we didn't have like that click and that list of artists, you know, and a lot of them, that generation that I, when I did go there, had already left Kansas City. So we kind of had that build it and they will come kind of thing. And I remember putting ads in the pitch, like looking for artists, and like people like didn't believe it that there was really a call, like asking for art.
Just for real.
Anyway, so, but that was another thing. The pitch was huge about you know, they would actually write reviews for shows. They had a calendar listing. The Star had calendar listing.
Those days,
So, I mean, there were ways that you could find out about some of those things. So,
You know, we're going to take a real quick break, and then we'll be back with Patrick Alexander. He's got some great stories in store, and so stick around.
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons.
And I'm Susan Sanders.
And this is Take Two, Two Takes at a Movie, currently playing in the Kansas City area. And today the topic is a motion picture epic from filmmaker Martin Scorsese, and it's called The Irishman.
Yes, it stars Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Joe Pesci. It's 3 hours long, and it's the story about Jimmy Hoffa and what happened. Special technology to make the older actors look younger in certain scenes, but I have some very big disappointments with this.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, I thought the technology to make them look younger didn't work all that well.
No.
And if you're going to get nitpicky, I was really bothered by Robert De Niro's blue contact lenses, which from time to time shined and showed that they were obviously fake. However, this is a really smart, well-executed film. Martin Scorsese's at the top of his form, and so are those three actors, particularly Joe Pesci, who I think was just brilliant in this movie. However, I think that the biggest drag on this movie is its length. It's not quite able to sustain the strong interest through 3 hours.
I agree, and I think it was an interesting history lesson. But for me, I was hugely disappointed. I thought that the acting was one-dimensional. I felt that everyone had the same facial expression, a scowl, whether they were young or old. And it was sort of like been there, done that, over and over and over.
Robert De Niro plays a hitman and a Teamster Union member who serves as a go-between between the mob and the Teamsters Union. There are aspects of this movie that I thought were exploitive,
yes,
to say the least, and it's very violent, but it is a savvy character study.
I wanted it to be. For me, it didn't work. As the plot unfolded, I didn't see any change whatsoever in any character.
I'm Russ Simmons.
And I'm Susan Sanders.
And this is Take Two.
And you're listening to Art Speak Radio. This is Maria Vasquez Boyd. Thanks for tuning in with us. You know, we're talking to Pat Alexander, and we're talking about the experiences that that he went through putting together an art gallery. So tell us more.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so like I said, this was like mid-90s that Kansas City in that time was definitely different than it is now. I mean, mm-hmm. It's hard to even describe it to people because it was the West Bottoms was a Wild West. I mean, it was a playground for artists for multiple decades.
I think there was different
generations that have come through there. I mean, you have Dale Eldridge down there, but in the 70s, you know, passed away down there with the floods, and you've got like Random Ranch and Philomene Bennett and them had their spaces down there forever. So it's always attractive these artists, creatives, I feel like, for many, many years. And maybe it was because of all the vice that was down there in its original days.
And the unofficial Nipsey Russell.
Nipsey Russell,
that
yeah.
That was next to the Red?
By the Fahrenheit in the War Room, which should have been before that, though. That was the landscape. Not a lot of artist-run spaces, but it all seemed like then it just started happening. All of a sudden, we opened up a space, and then it was like, oh, do you know this guy Stretch? He's got a place called The Zone Gallery. There's another one. It's called Celsius Smith. There's another one called The Opie Brush. And, they just were all these little ones you just kept hearing about. It was like, oh, you don't have a gallery? That's kind of crazy. But there were all these cool collectives, and I felt like every single gallery kind of was a shtick covered, you know, a different sort of thing that was maybe missing. So, for us, it was a lot about graffiti art. It was about performance art, video. That was just what we were into. And so if you didn't see it being represented, you're like, well, I guess we got to do it. And that's kind of what the mentality, I feel, has always been in Kansas City, why artists run these spaces. They want a voice. And there's that opportunity to have a voice.
You know, it's really interesting as you're talking, and even when we were on break, everyone is nodding their heads because it's almost like a euphoric recall because that was a great time. That was a great energy. I'm not saying that it's isn't that way anymore, but it was just a very different time that you can't really describe.
I mean, it was about experiences. Mm-hmm. I think, and again, rip on the social media, which is great, and it's amazing for an artist-run space now. But at that time, you had to go out and, I heard about it. Somebody gave me a flyer while I was at, club or whatever in Westport, the record store. And they said, come check this out. And it's like, well, that looks like a cool flyer. You know, he's a good artist, so I might as well check it out. So you had to go out, and you didn't have digital pictures or phones taking pictures. So you couldn't even see it if you missed it. You know, whereas I feel like now you've been there, but you didn't go, you know, kind of thing like that.
I will submit my slides, you know.
Yeah, oh, gosh. slides. I mean, I remember getting slides from artist to show, and like I was like, we got to find a slide projector. But yeah, that was a big deal when that switched. I can't even imagine. Like, I remember I had friends who worked at blue chip galleries, and they would talk about how they would just throw those slides in the trash, not even look at them. And you're just like, those were the reasons why. You're like, oh, we got to just do this.
So how long did your place?
So we had it from 97 to 99, which doesn't sound like it was that long, but it was monthly shows plus other performances happening. It was just a lot of programming going on and with music stuff. So, and we lived there same. So it was just like day to day. There was constantly things going on, either with, we would let other people like Glenn North and the Verbal Attack rehearse there. And we had, Lisa Cortez's performance art class was in there. They had a semester because they didn't have a space. Yeah. We did a lot of weird stuff with kind of saving artists from the Art Institute. I remember, like, we did Mate was an artist in residence from Africa, and they hadn't given him a solo show while he was here, and we thought it was crazy. And so he was a Rasta dude, and we were kind of in that crew. And so we let him come and have a studio at the gallery, and then did a show there. It was huge, you know. Those were kind of, again, those, I don't know, punk rock, show you Art Institute.
You know, and it's interesting, again, with your experience, you actually are continuing to make art and DJ.
Yeah.
So it's not like life is, you know, once you've had this gallery, it's like, poof.
That's where disappear. I got, I mean, that got me the career that I made that career. Yeah. I mean, I didn't go to school to be a curator or to how to run an art gallery. You had to roll it up and do it. And I mean, so now, I mean, at one point was running three galleries and two performance space for Charlotte Street, you know, it's nice to get paid to do it versus just investing your own time and money all the time. So, but there is that loss too of like your voice of, you know, when you're in a nonprofit versus an artist run space.
Sure. You know, we've got a couple more underwriting spots to air, and then we're going to be, we'll be right back with Pat Alexander, Renee Cinderhouse, Hector Casanova, and then we're going to bring on Coy Emig and Melanie N. Mitchell. Stay tuned.
Supporting KKFI, Cupini's, family-owned and operated with catering for your business meetings, family gatherings, or any meal where you just don't want to have to clean the kitchen. Paninis, pasta, and desserts are just a few of the offerings they have had since 2003. Full catering menu at cupinis.com. That's CUPINIS.com.
Did you know your business or organization could be sponsoring this episode of Art Speak Radio? Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
And I'm back. I was trying to take a photo of everyone during those breaks, so I'm back. And we're back with Coy Emig and Melanie Mitchell. We're going to talk about a project that they're working on, which is a project, it's a part of a larger national project about talking about these artist-run spaces. So welcome, my friends.
Thanks.
Hi.
You can pull
thank you so much for having us.
You bet. You bet. So this national project is a collaboration between Patty Johnson, Dulcie Bohm. Bohm. Uh-huh. And, of course, Coy. Talk about it. What does it offer? What are you doing the research for and all?
Well, so I'll start off talking about the national project, and then maybe, Melanie, you can talk a little bit about the Kansas City version of this. So this national project is documenting spaces that we heard about this morning, spaces, artist-run spaces, all across the country. As we've heard today, there's a huge history of this in Kansas City, but there's a history like this in a lot of other cities all across the country. So we want to document this and create an archive of these spaces and the spaces that have closed. Talk about the impact that these spaces have had in all of these communities.
So Impractical Spaces involves a symposium and a publication organized by you and Melanie focused on the history and impact of artist-run spaces in Kansas City. I love that.
Yeah.
It's so important, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the last time that we were all five of us were in a room together was at the Kansas City Artists Coalition right before they moved. And it was for our symposium event that was a documentation and dialogue event showcasing these stories about the artist run in Kansas City. And I think it's important, especially in Kansas City, to document these spaces because there was no documentation. You didn't know who was doing what or what questions were being asked. And the artist run always comes from this place of alternative, or this isn't something that I see happening, or this isn't my friend's work isn't being shown, or I really want to see more of this or that. And this history is just kind of what, you know, you do as an artist. You kind of step into this space and you say, okay, I'm gonna make space for those around me to show their work.
So did you initially have this idea and then were able to partner with these other organizations that are doing this, the documentation of the artist-run spaces?
Yeah, so Corey and I, our collaboration began when I did a similar publication a couple of years ago called Artist Run KC that documented folks who had won Charlotte Street Awards and had also run Artist Run Spaces in Kansas City. And those were interviews that were all published on Informality, which is a local arts blog here. And so we were just focusing on that. And then Corey was working on this project with Patty and Dulcie and came to me and said, hey, you know, let's put our minds together and find a way to really expand this documentation to more spaces.
So how do you begin to tackle this project? Because it seems really huge and very time-consuming and all that. And, of course, it is very important. But, I mean, where do you begin?
It's been, it has been trial and error. We've used social media a lot, but, you know, we've come into a lot of challenges because a lot of people that have run spaces like this maybe are no longer in Kansas City or are no longer making art, or we just don't know them. So it's been a lot of having conversations with people, asking them to remember, you know, 20 years ago, and try to put us in touch with some of these people.
So what is sort of the timeline of documenting these artist-run spaces? Are we looking at the 60s? Are we looking at before that time? Or are we looking more 70s? Do you have anything?
Most of our documentation from Kansas City is from the 90s to currently, but we do have a few stories of spaces. So Linda Layton, who's currently an artist in Kansas City, her grandmother ran an artist-run space on the west side. Was it back in the 30s or
in the
40s?
30s, yeah.
Yeah, and I always get the name wrong.
Yeah.
It's
Well, it was originally a brothel. So that was, it has such an interesting history, and that will be part of just hearing her talk about her grandmother's history with, like, what then became this space that, you know, the West Side in the 90s and early 2000s was a place for a lot of artist-run spaces. And so it's so interesting to see, okay, you know, you cover, it's like archaeology. You know, you'd like take a little bit of dirt off, and then you're like, oh, wait, that happened, or that was a thing. I was sitting across from two of the founders of the Kansas City Artists Coalition recently, having a conversation with them and just hearing them state their reasons for starting the Forum magazine that was run by the Artists Coalition, or starting the coalition itself, and that idea of mutual growth through group support really stuck out to me as a thing that this is the underbelly of why all of these spaces have existed for so long.
Do you have a time frame? I mean, do you want to be concluded with your research and then move to the next part of the project? Do you have a certain timeline that you have given yourself?
Yeah, so we are doing, we are asking people that have run artist-run spaces to fill out an online questionnaire about their space, or to sit down with us and just have a conversation that we record.
Now, is this ongoing? I mean, or is it
this
sort
is
of
ongoing
the...
until we're hoping to have it kind of wrap those up within the next month before the end of the year. And then in the spring, we'll shift to kind of laying this publication out and gathering all the documentation.
Yeah, and Corey and I also recognize that we are doing this as an artist-run initiative as well. And while there might be things that don't necessarily get covered, we're hoping that this is a starting point to where it starts to, you know, invigorate others to either start these spaces or to continue this research and to realize how rich this history is in Kansas City and how much this is often the thing that asks the questions that all artists are trying to ask, these conversations that are trying to happen throughout the community.
Wow, you know, that's a really valuable project. I'm talking to Melanie Mitchell and Corey Emig, and they're talking about impractical spaces. It's focused on the history and impact of artist-run spaces in Kansas City. A lot of work to be done on this. Are there, are there any other sort of gallery spaces that you discovered that you didn't realize that you didn't know about during this project? Because I know with Renee and Hector and Patrick, you know, they were verbal about their space and how that was running. But are you finding some pleasant surprises?
Definitely. I'm finding out about a lot of spaces, and sometimes it's just a name of a space and we haven't been able to actually find any more information out about it, or we don't know who actually ran it.
Yeah, because you want to be inclusive, but you don't want to kind of leave anyone out that really had an impact in the gallery scene, right?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and just as Pat was talking about, like, a lot of these spaces we didn't have cameras on our cell phones. We didn't have social media. Yeah. And so people weren't taking pictures of their spaces to post publicly, to talk about what was going on. And so tracking down images of these spaces has also been a huge challenge, because it was just documentation was for a different purpose. A lot of times it's like, I'm going to take a picture of a bunch of my friends in a space, and it's not necessarily, let's take a picture of the gallery with the art and post that online. So that's been a challenge that we've been coming up against in learning about spaces.
Well, and I was pleased that Hector sent me some images for this program for the Facebook event page. So I really enjoyed seeing those. Hector?
One thing that I wanted to interject is that, you know, as we mentioned, when we started the gallery, we really had only planned on having, we really only thought as far as that first show, and then we just kept going. But I think that was very common, that there was so much space and there were so many artists would just get organized and then would have a show or two or three. And then after that, they would just dissipate. So there were dozens of these short bursts of creativity, where artist-run spaces would pop up and they might last for anywhere from a month to 6 months, and then they would just disappear entirely. And again, there was hardly any documentation of any of those. So they were happening all over the place back through the 90s and early 2000s. We kept going with the gallery, with the Green Door Gallery, because we very expressly didn't want to just become one of those many spaces that would pop up and then kind of dissolve. So I completely understand, Corey and Melanie have an uphill battle, because there were dozens of these, and many of them were short-lived and not documented at all.
Well, it's even like Pat was saying, too, I mean, to touch on the idea that so many of these artist-run spaces were experience-based. It wasn't about the documentation. It wasn't about the social media. It wasn't about the lingering result thereof. It was about being there to experience that thing at that particular moment with that group of people. Even what you were saying about mutual growth through collaboration, that is something that in that moment in the late 90s to early 2000s, the West Bottoms really had, because it was not competitive. We often would collaborate to have multi-gallery events. There were large exhibitions like Sequence or Culture Under Fire, where all of the artist-run galleries would participate in. And that was a game changer, and it was a much different conversation for all of us to be having artistically at that moment in time.
You know, and I find it really interesting with Pat Alexander, who's with Charlotte Street now. It's all about documentation, you know, for artists. Not that it hasn't ever been that way, but it's a different documentation, I think, for artists today that perhaps you work with, right, Patrick?
Oh, yeah. It's huge. Now, this to get documentation, that's how you get your next show. That's how, you know, curators are checking you out on Instagram. I mean, it's huge. But, I mean, as I'm working on I've done similar things on this research, and it is, it's challenging. I think there is that part where you do have to start collecting and just getting the names, and it just kind of starts opening up. And it's a huge endeavor, and it's needed. So I think it's always important to, for especially like right now in Kansas City, there's a lot of interesting, cool stuff happening. There's a lot of change happening. But with that, I think understanding that there is this community that's been going on for decades is pretty amazing. It's pretty special here. And it's not, I think sometimes it's taken for granted for if you live here and when you go off to other places.
Well, I certainly know that. Just for my friend Christina Munoz, who talks about, and now she's in San Antonio, and saying how rich this art community is in Kansas City, and really sort of not the same where she's at in San Antonio. I want if you would both tell us the Impractical Spaces and a website or any information, contact information, or anything social media that our listeners might want to know.
So if you go ahead, our email is impracticalspaceskc@gmail.com if you're interested in getting involved. And we also have a Google form that we can send out if you are wanting to submit answers or your own story of your own artist run space, or we can even set up an appointment. Corey and I have some studio hours still coming up through early next month to collect information, to do scanning, recording sessions, those types of things. So we're still kind of wrapping up that ending research phase, and we want folks to reach out.
And I think it's important to note that also we're not just looking at one specific area like the West Bottoms or the East Bottoms or, you know, Crossroads and that. You know, one gallery that comes to mind was run by Christophe, who was a Frenchman. I want to say it was the, well, it was in the 18th and Vine area. I don't recall the name of it, but he had a very small gallery, and then some of the artists that he employed in the gallery space, he took them to a trip to Africa where they went to Burkina Faso. I'll have to think about that. But I mean, we're just not looking at the West Bottoms, East Bottoms, Crossroads. We're looking just, even in Westport, there were you know,
gallery spaces. Yeah, there were a lot of apartment galleries in Westport in the 90s. One I've heard about.
And then Jan Weiner.
Yeah.
So that was in her home.
Yeah. So it's interesting. We're definitely learning a lot and meeting a lot of people that maybe we've heard about but hadn't had the chance to meet.
Yeah, good. Well, you know, I want to thank you all so, so very much. I feel like 1 hour is not even enough to really begin to have a discussion about this. Perhaps we can look at some other times and have you come back if you're interested, and kind of tell us about what's happening with the project and all that. Certainly have everyone back here. How's that?
Yeah.
Sounds good. Great.
Thanks. It's been great. Thank you.
Good. Yeah,
thank you so much.
You bet. And, you know, we're going to let you know that next week we have, we're in December, December 4th. We're going to talk to Pendleton Arts Block folks. And I think, Hector, are you going to be around for that? Are you going to join us on that conversation next week?
I could if you'd like me to.
Of course, of course. So we'll look for Hector Casanova and Cheyenne Squire and Shanae Williams. They'll be talking about the Pendleton Arts Block. And I think it's a really interesting discussion that we're going to have about that. Thank you to Renee Cinderhouse, Hector Casanova, Corey Emig, and Melanie Mitchell, Patrick Alexander. Thank you all so very much. You know, have a wonderful Turkey Day. And, you know, think about the people who are absent at your table in your home. And we love you all. Hey, honey, I'm coming home. I'm out of here. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned next for Jeff Harshbarger, Jazz Afternoon, coming up at 1 o'clock.